Okay, well, let's talk about a little bit about the advisory bodies. The three advisory bodies, ICOMOS, ICROM, and IUCN, are the three formally associated with the convention. And my first question is, do you know why they were chosen and why other international organizations were not chosen? Are you aware of all that background?
No, I'm not actually.
I'm not either. That's why I'm
No,
asking the
that's
question.
interesting.
There must have been a lot of vying for that position at the time.
Well, certainly on the cultural side, more I don't think in the, this sounds arrogant. I don't think in the, on the natural side there would have been all that much difficulty because of the preeminent role that IUCN already enjoyed in the protected areas field. This was established through the 60s, so by 1972 it was already kind of wide, and many of the key people who played a part in creating the convention from the natural side, particularly people from the States, were also key people in IUCN and what was then called CNPPA, the Commission on National Parks and Protected Areas, WCPA now. So I think it was kind of it was logical, because whereas bodies like WWF, which were already in being, were seen essentially as pressure groups and fundraisers. I mean, there's much more to WWF than that, but that was the perception. IUCN was seen as, in quotation marks, scientific and objective in this field. So, but I just don't know about ICOMOS and ICROM. It does raise the question as to whether that arrangement set up in stone in 1972 is still relevant. And I think there are some. Well, it's obviously not helpful for the committee to have half a dozen bodies advising it. And they got in a tangle when they had two. I think one area which I don't think is adequately covered and falls between the two is the cultural landscape area. And I think it's because it's in the nature of landscape and landscape issues that it is a meeting ground between different disciplines and concepts. And meeting grounds are quite difficult to represent in professional institutes. It's probable that if you did it now, you might ask IFLA, the International Federation of Landscape Architects, to fulfill that role with a very specific charge upon them to be consulted on landscape matters. And another area within IUCN's expertise, which has been revealed as being quite a problem, is that IUCN is essentially about the biological sciences, and it doesn't have much expertise on the earth sciences. And yet, that's criteria, what is it now?
Yeah, it
Seven.
was no, it's now Criterion 8.
But look at the sites on the list. It'll just take the United States. I mean, the Grand Canyon, it has some biodiversity interest, but it's not really there because of its biodiversity interest. Carlsbad Caverns, similarly. Even the Glacier, so and the whole range of other ones too, are sites there essentially because of the drama of earth sciences. And the convention recognizes that, and IUCN struggles a bit with that. And we did special arrangements for the Institute of Geological Sciences, or what is it not called, the Institute now. Anyhow, it's the bit of ICSU that deals with earth sciences and so forth. So I think that relying exclusively on those three organizations probably no longer gives the convention quite the breadth of expertise it needs.
I just wanted to be, while we're still on the advisory bodies, to ask you to assess their performance, their strengths and weaknesses, because each organization is a different kind of
Very
organization
different,
and functions differently.
Well, let's deal with ICROM first, which is a kind of relatively easy one. I always found them extremely constructive and helpful, very focused on what they could do, not trying to do things that they couldn't do. They were good both in the relation to the training work that the committee wanted developed, and specifically within the operational guidelines. And the individuals there, I thought, were very good. I mean, Herb and others, so Kitrin, and so I thought there was a good organization. I found ICOMOS more problematic, and I think part of ICOMOS's problem is that World Heritage is almost their raison d'être. So there's a huge expectation laid on them and internally within them to perform. And they're faced with an in some ways a much more complex and difficult job than IUCN has, because of the culturally related nature of assessment of culture, which doesn't really arise in the scientific field and in the IUCN field to the same extent, in the sense that, you know, an Indian biologist will have the same view about something as a North American one or a Fiji one. Whereas I think that you have real difficulties in within ICOMOS in having that degree of understanding the many, many different cultural positions that people might come to in looking at whether something is of outstanding universal value. As you know, I mean, some cultural landscapes have very high natural values. Thingvellir in Iceland is the sort of one of several which I went and looked at. Where, you know, there is an important cultural bit. That's the origin of the Icelandic nation and so forth. But you've also got this incredible place where the earth is splitting open. You've got this the Atlantic divide between the two tectonic plates open. You can see it with your eyes. You can even feel it because it sort of shakes practically every day a little bit. It's the most dramatic place in telling the earth science story as well as a cultural story. But the convention says, for reasons that, if you go back into the Santa Fe discussions in 1992, you can understand why cultural landscapes are regarded as on the cultural side.
My memory of the beginning of the cultural landscapes universe is that IUCN didn't really step up to the plate and didn't really want to be involved in it. Is that correct? And that sort of ICOMOS ended up taking over the assessment, really, of cultural landscapes by default, in a sense.
I'm not sure it's completely true. Certainly, the dear late Bing Lucas was a very strong advocate for it, and he was at that stage had the position. Was he at that stage the chairman of the WCPA? But he was also, I think so, because he was my.
Yes, I think so too.
That. And he was also much involved in the drafting of the definition of cultural landscapes, the identification of those three categories, you know, associative and designed.
Mm-hmm. Right, and right. The two meetings.
But that's right. I think one was at Santa Fe, wasn't it? One was at somewhere else.
Santa Fe is where it was presented to the committee, but one was at La Petite Pierre.
Petite Pierre. And he was very much in that. And by all accounts, he was one of the people who took a lead in that. So to that extent, I think IUCN, through Bing's involvement, was very actively involved. However, my understanding was that it partly went back to what in the roots of the convention itself, where best this could sit. And because of the wording under the cultural bit of the pillar of the convention, it fitted more happily under that. Under sites, yes, than it did under the natural properties. And that that meant it had to be led by ICOMOS. And there are lots of cultural landscapes where ICOMOS, you know, would just get a letter from IUCN quite rightly saying we have no interest, or there is no natural interest here of any great importance. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few where there's a considerable amount, and there are some where you could well argue the natural things are as important, or if not more important. It's a rather foolish way of looking at it, but you couldn't possibly look at it without taking into account the huge natural site significance.
Right. It's still an area that I think challenges the committee.
Yeah, I think it challenges the bodies too. Mm-hmm. But there's also a good deal more to be said about IUCN than just obviously about cultural landscapes. I mentioned that for ICOMOS, World Heritage is the raison d'etre. It's right at the centre. And if World Heritage Committee collapsed tomorrow, I think ICOMOS would pretty well collapse, or would be rather pointless little organisation. That's not true of IUCN. If the World Heritage Committee were wrapped up tomorrow, there'd be a few tears, but IUCN would roll on. And it, you know, I don't know, sort of 2% of its activities or something. It's quite small. The difficulty in IUCN was to try and get people, other than the team who had direct involved in it, to appreciate the significance and the potential that lay in the convention to achieve IUCN's wider purposes. And that's considerable. because you can use World Heritage Sites as standard setters. You can use them to focus on issues of much wider significance, mining in protected areas. The whole debate about mining in protected areas, which really has set IUCN alight, started with the kind of problems we had in Huascarán, well, and Kakadu and half a dozen other properties, World Heritage properties, and it spread out to be a debate about mining in protected areas as a whole.